Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me here today. We've been doing this a number of years now. I can't remember how many, but it truly is an honor and so sweet. And it's become a thing that our two sanghas do together. We haven't done bocce ball tournament yet, but this is the heart of the matter here. Yeah.
Bocce ball's coming.
Yeah. And though I've been here with you a number of times, and I feel, most importantly, I feel deeply cared for when I come here. I can really, it just feels that way. And yet, there are times when I have no idea what's going to happen next, which is a this nice kind of combination of things, you know. I know I'm cared for. I feel deeply held. I don't know what's going to, you know, are they bells, teasers, you know. And it's, you know, it's not too strident. It's just that little bit. But I think that's a nice thing for me to appreciate and for us all to appreciate, that in this life, even though it may not always be so easy to appreciate, I think this practice allows us to feel deeply held and still not knowing what's going to happen next. So that may be one image for our practice today. Part of the talk, the title of the talk was "The Whole World Alive." And another title might have been "Going Beyond Despair." So I feel like I hear a lot of stories of despair and feel it myself these days. So I'd like to look at how opening to this whole world alive that we inhabit and express in our every action can rescue us from despair and put us back on the track to do all the work that needs to be done. Another image that I'm actually going to conclude with, but I can't help but mention now, a little piece by Dogen that the translators have entitled "Jumping and Stumbling in a Fragrant World." So there's this fragrant world that is kind of reaching out to us, and we have our jumping and stumbling. It also occurs to me that it's a good image for Soto practitioners doing Rinzai walking meditation on a beautiful summer morning. There is such a sweet smell out there, and jumping and stumbling, myself included. So there are lots of stories of despair out there. Bonnie and I were walking in Seward Park, a beautiful park in Seattle that is right close to us, but holds a great old-growth forest. And it was a day like today, and we ran across one of our friends up in the woods who is monitoring a die-off of sword ferns. Sword ferns are, you know, a particular indigenous type of fern, and apparently there's there's a die-off happening. Bonnie and I can never quite spot it because there are ferns all over the place. But so we ran into our friend and we said, oh, you know, hey, what a beautiful day. How are you doing? And he said something like, all I see is death. You know, I'm monitoring these sword ferns. You know, he's explaining the situation to somebody. So he's really in the midst of this, focusing on this phenomena. It's not that it's not real, but he's monitoring death and doesn't really, is in a different place. So I chirped something like, well, don't forget to monitor life. And, you know, I think that comes into the category of unskillful comments. But nevertheless, it was striking to me, these two different worlds that either met or failed to meet there in the park. So two different stories. One full of despair and one full of new life. So you could say that my friend, our friend Paul, was a realist and I was kind of a Pollyanna, or you could say he was caught in a story of despair and I didn't allow myself to be, and neither one is quite the truth. So I'd like to explore that today, this fragment world, totally alive, and yet many stories of despair. In case you don't have one handy, I'll mention a few just to you know, help you with that. There are all the things that our president does from day to day. I won't go into those. There are true stories of species going extinct, and it's hard not to despair when we think of some creature that will never be alive on the earth again. And then there's our basic human predicament. This story was in the paper this week on aging. I don't know if you caught it, but it's written by a woman from the Los Angeles Times. And she's having a little fun with us here, I think. She says, aging might be perfectly natural, but as practiced by the human body, it is beginning to look more and more like a disease, and a treatable one at that. That's kind of the gist of the article. But here's her story about our predicament. In a new study, scientists reveal aging to be a process set in motion by the rise of malign forces called senescent cells, which progressively hijack the body and take it on a nightmarish joyride. With advancing age, senescent cells take the wheel and the body careens into disease states ranging from cancer and diabetes to arthritis, vision loss, and dementia. As senescent cells mount, our walking pace and cognitive processing speeds slow, our grips weaken, and disabilities mount. Eventually, driven by this accumulation of insults, we go straight off a cliff. And she had to be having fun with this, right? But I really appreciated that. But yet, we do buy into a similar story, I think, quite often when we view our predicament, our human predicament, from a certain vantage point. So we laugh, and yet we find ourselves there from time to time, maybe in despair. Closer to home, my family, now that my father died, three of our families, the three siblings, own a small lake cabin in northern Minnesota, and you know, we just can't agree on how to furnish it. Why did you put that wire rack in the bathroom? Well, it's for my hair dryers and stuff. Why did you take down those drapes? They were filthy and disgusting. So I have a little despair over, can we not, three families, agree on how to furnish a cabin? But I'm right in there with the rest of them, preferring the drapes, but not the wire rack. So I'm just going to go on here for a little bit. We were kayaking in the near San Juan's a couple weeks ago, and between Guaymas Island and Cypress Island, if you know the area. And we were crossing between the two islands, which is a substantial crossing, and we saw a bunch of boats kind of going slowly along the opposite shore. And sure enough, there were some orcas there that they were following. So it was a wonderful thing to see orcas, although we were pretty far away from them. And we saw, you know, black fins and spouts, not a whole lot else. But they were being closely followed, and boats were coming in from several directions to observe this. And of course, I was paddling as fast as I could in my kayak, but I was pretty far back. It seemed like the orcas were being sort of pinned against the shoreline by all these boats and harassed, and so it was a wonderful thing, but kind of sad as well. Later, we turned around and came back to Guaymas, and as we were paddling right along the shore, we saw this four-legged animal standing up straight on a rock, which this animal had to be a coyote. I thought, maybe it's a dog. No, it had to be a coyote. And in its way, it was so proud and so visible and so close. It was more magnificent than the orcas, and more reassuring and more inspiring. Of course, this is a story that could be read a couple ways. It could be that, you know, our beautiful indigenous species are being harassed and these invasive coyotes are taking over. But I choose to see it a different way. And that our shape-shifting world keeps reappearing in a different manifestation of wonder, moment to moment. So we're looking today at this, at a not only a different story, but a story that takes us beyond stories, I would say. So we don't have to argue about stories, but we can open to the many changing stories that arise moment to moment. So I think our tradition, you know, if nothing else, it provides a practice to help us go beyond despair. And if not, you know, maybe something's wrong, but I think it does. And one of the ways I like to characterize that aspect of the practice is Buddha's posture of touching the earth, right? What your Buddha is doing up there, we can't see, but many Buddha figures are shown in this posture with Buddha touching the earth. And that is Buddha, I think, us, I think, reconnecting with the larger world, knowing, remembering finally that we can't do it all by ourselves, and we have to connect with this larger world, otherwise we may be overcome by despair. So touching the earth is one metaphor. But something I'd like to play with a little today is the notion of what's alive and what's dead. And so our biologists, and I know we have some here, and I have been one myself, and have, well, work hard to determine what it means to be alive. And there are several definitions, many definitions. One of them is the condition, life is a characteristic that distinguishes physical entities that do have biological processes, such as signaling and self-sustaining processes, from those that do not, either because such functions have ceased or because they never had such functions to begin with and are classified as inanimate. Other characteristics of life, capacity for growth, reproduction, functional activity, continual change preceding death. So we can say, certainly say yes to these, applied to the organisms that we are familiar with. And it is a useful distinction, no doubt, very real. And yet, I think, like so many other things, our insistence that something is either alive or dead goes too far. It holds our mind in the grip of a polarity that is not entirely helpful. So exploring the whole world alive. Normally we believe in this great gulf between what's living and what's dead. And when something passes from one to the other, it crosses the great river, right? And it's and again, there is utility to noticing the changes, but yet I think we go too far. This, our common definitions of life insist on the separateness of things, right? Separate things, either alive or dead. But when we release our insistence on the separateness of things, then our ability to see life everywhere increases and is helpful, I believe. Taking us beyond despair if we let it. About a month ago, there were some cottonwood trees on the other side of the neighbor's house, and they would continually drift, right, the seeds, until they looked almost like snow in places. But this thing, this little seed, with this wispy attachment that's drifting on the wind. So we know that that seed is alive. And yet our common view would say that the moving air is dead and this seed is alive. And yet how can this moving seed be separate from what we call the wind, what we call the air, riding it, moving on it, extending out into it? It's a single process if we allow it to be, if we allow our view to open in that way. And I don't think this is Pollyannish. I think it is grounding in something that helps us come back to do the work. Another image that I find that images kind of say it all for me, and the words are a little bit extraneous. But so another image that I came across during our spring session in the Book of Serenity was the spring winds blowing stirs the ashes in the pipe. And the spring winds blowing stirs the ashes in the pipe. And this needs some translation. So apparently what's going on here is there was a ritual in ancient China where they would put ashes into a bamboo tube, which was the pipe, and somehow when the spring wind blew across it, it would puff out the ashes into the air. And you know, you can imagine the sight. But again, what I felt when I read that was that this is life in death and death in life. This is, I refuse to separate those things out. This is a living world that is holding us and manifesting itself for us. So this is a different story that I believe goes beyond stories. But, you know, how does this perception, how does this actually happen in this, you know, we should probably spend a lot of time on this, but we won't. But we can tell ourselves a story and say, yes, yes, that's nice. But that doesn't change our experience of life. And so this practice is about sitting deeply with great dedication until our experience of life changes on its own, until the world presents itself as a living thing. So it's as if these inanimate things are calling out to us almost. And, you know, you might say that's going too far, and we'll talk more about that in a minute. But when we truly open to whatever this cup here, it's not a cup. It's, and I'm not me. And this is a dialogue. This is a process. This is an exchange that, to my mind, has every hallmark of life. So sitting deeply and dropping preconceptions, allowing the mind to calm, letting our ideas about what things are drop away until the presence of this incredible life is felt. And the separateness of things is just a story. So as Koshin said today, let's dedicate ourselves to this deep work here on this great opportunity of a day to sit all day in a beautiful spot held by loving people. At least, let's dedicate ourselves to this deep work. So lest you think that this story of mine of the whole world being alive is just this cockamamie mystic kind of thing, there are scientists that are beginning to agree with us, to agree with, align themselves with a similar story. And there is new ideas, there are new ideas about evolution that lead us in the same direction. The two dominant ideas about evolution have been one, intelligent design, that is, some divine consciousness creates matter, and the other is random genetic variation, evolution based on random genetic variation and natural selection, where matter somehow creates consciousness. So these two different views. And what cosmologists and evolutionary scientists seem to be moving toward is an idea that is in between those two, that the universe is not a stage on which evolution happens, but it is the process itself, the drama itself. There is no drama separate from the stage. It is unfolding. The universe is the unfolding. Another way to put it is evolution is an intelligent dance between organism and environment. The cosmos is self-organizing. So something about this vast thing we call a universe, these people are saying, I can't cite all the evidence, but that this is, there is a self-organizing thing that is happening here. Another quote. At the cutting edge of contemporary science, a remarkable insight is surfacing. The universe, with all things in it, is a quasi-living, coherent whole. All things in it are connected. Sound familiar? A cosmos that is connected, coherent, and whole recalls all the ancient notions present in early traditions. It is an enchanted cosmos. We are part of each other and of nature. We are a conscious part of the world, a being through which the cosmos comes to know itself. So our awareness is the awareness of the vast whole beginning to know itself. That's mind-blowing, isn't it? But it allows us to be there in the middle of this incredible process. And also, our awareness is the cosmos knowing itself, and our opening to the things of the world is the cosmos knowing us. And you can find your own words to make this work for you, to help this story lead you to the sense that, to the experience that, again, that we are one thing becoming aware of itself. We are being lived by the one life. Our life is no more than that. And when I don't know about you, but when I touch the earth in this way, my small stories of my own despair are not so compelling. And gratitude emerges and energy to go forward. Evolution is the creative groping of a self-organizing cosmos that is becoming more self-aware. So that's just, that idea is out there for us to explore if it interests us, but it helps relieve some skepticism in my mind. There's an example that bacteria, when they're under stress, and a population of bacteria is under stress, mutations occur at a much more rapid pace. So it's funny, we normally think that the genetic material is guiding the whole process, but somehow when the population is under stress, the genetic material starts changing more rapidly in order to evolve. I don't know. I think that to me that suggests something bigger is happening. Our teaching is, as I said, I think very rich with this fundamental faith that we are being held. So a couple more examples of that. One night when Dongbo visited Mount Lu, he was enlightened upon hearing the sound of the valley stream. He composed the following verse, which he presented to Chang Zong. Valley sounds are the long, broad tongue. Mountain colors are no other than the unconditioned body. 84,000 verses are heard throughout the night. What can I say about this at a future time? So valley sounds and mountain colors are reciting the sutras, are teaching Buddha's teaching. They are expounding the Dharma, if we have ears to hear it. So in our Soto teaching, we like to, and Dogen likes to really emphasize this idea that inanimate, so-called inanimate objects are expounding the Dharma. And of course, they're not actually speaking in language, right? How many languages could a rock actually know? I mean, to speak in tongues. But when we are open to it, in a sense, it speaks to us of our non-separateness, because when we are open to it, it challenges our idea of non-separateness until it falls away. And this awareness is cultivated in our zazen and in our one-day sits and those longer. To further steep us in this idea, a central teaching of Dogen's: to carry the self forward and illuminate myriad things is delusion. That myriad things come forth and illuminate the self is awakening. So again, to carry the self forward and illuminate myriad things is delusion. But that's kind of what we're trying to do most of the time, right? We're trying to go out there and illuminate things, understand, get whatever there is to be gotten, and never stop. But Dogen says that myriad things come forth and illuminate the self, reveal the self, is awakening. That we can be open and stable enough to be awoken by all the myriad dharmas, all the myriad things of this life. And I think when we hear this teaching, at least for a moment, we know it's true. It might slip away, but there is a experience of truth there often, I think. So when we get caught in despair, can we touch the earth and allow ourselves to be illuminated by the myriad things? I think so. But it's not about hanging out in bliss, right? It's about becoming part of this universe that wants to know itself. Did I read that part? We are a conscious part of the world, yes. The universe. Discovering the knowledge of itself. So ending with Dogen, jumping and stumbling, he says, when we exhaust our strength to express it, the pillars help us from the sidelines. The windows and the lamps and the floor help us from the sidelines with half a word. Training the mind and verifying enlightenment, a wooden ladle energetically adds another mouthful for sustenance, for practice. So the ladles downstairs on the lunch table are just dying to help us out. They're going to be dishing out sustenance for our practice. If we are alive to that world. Without awakening, advancing each step, we stumble over our feet, making 7 mistakes and 8 mistakes. Without resting, taking a step backward, we stumble over our exposed legs, arriving at 2 and arriving at 3, jumping and stumbling, and the fragrance of the world reaches out to us, calling us to let go of this fixation on separateness, this fixation on our own separate stories of despair, and join in, express this life as best we can. Hungry people still need to be fed. Ecosystems need to be cared for. Many things need to be done. But as Zogen ends, last night a flower blossomed and the whole world became fragrant. This morning a fruit ripened and awakening matured. The fragrant world was responded to and awoke to itself as manifested in each one of us. Thank you so much for listening and for bringing us all here.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.